Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does the Patty Hearst case tell us about America in the 1970s? Kidnapped at gunpoint when she was 19 years old, the media heiress soon fell in with her captors, participating in armed robberies, denouncing her wealthy family, and evading federal authorities. At trial, her attorney argued she had been brutalized and brainwashed and complied out of fear for her life. The case sparked fierce debates over what had really happened and who should be held accountable. But ultimately, Hearst was sentenced to 7 years behind bars. She served nearly two before being released by Jimmy Carter and later fully pardoned by Bill Clinton. 34 years after the kidnapping, writer William Grabner says the facts of her story may always be somewhat unclear, but he believes the case's relationship to the zeitgeist of a changing America can now be viewed with great clarity. His new book is called Patty's Got a Gun, Patricia Hearst in 1970s America. Bill, welcome to Think.
Well, thanks for having me.
You write that Patricia Hearst was a perfect object of disaffection and a powerful representative of what had gone wrong with America. What made her that symbol?
Well, she was part of a very radical, violent group that was identified correctly or incorrectly as part of the 60s. You know, it helped, of course, that she was in the Bay Area, which was well known as a hotbed of radicalism since the free speech movement in 1964 and a number of other events. And I think also the prosecution, that is the government, found it useful to identify her strongly with the 60s, you know, with the excesses of the 60s, because the country had really turned against that era by the time she was tried, and it played well, I think, with the jury and more generally with the American people.
How might someone have described Patricia Hearst before she was ever kidnapped?
Well, it's interesting. In a 2003 documentary. The documentary actually features her on a talk show, and she comes down the staircase on the talk show, sits down, and the person who's running the talk show asks her a question and about her background, and she said, "Oh, it was completely normal," something like that. And then the program ends. I mean, and it is kind of stunning. I mean, to think of this woman from a really normal, reasonably normal background would have been involved in the things that she was involved in. But that's really the case. I mean, she was although her family was wealthy. You know, she was part of the Hearst heritage, and her father was the publisher of the San Francisco Examiner. She had four sisters. She was physically active. She was involved with the country club scene. Her parents were not especially permissive. She describes her mother as pretty strict. She went to Catholic schools, which she didn't like, and that's certainly a common experience. She loved to ride horseback and fearlessly, apparently. She lived a pretty normal life. That's the way she describes it.
And she wasn't, in fact, living much like a wealthy person at the time that she was abducted. She lived with her fiance and did her own laundry and basically had a pretty modest existence.
She certainly did. Yeah. In fact, she even went to work doing billing at a local department store called Capwell's, and I think partly too. You know, because she knew that that's the kind of experience she didn't have. You know, that sort of antsy. So she was dipping into the ordinary life, I think, in an attempt to sort of find herself. She, if there's anything she didn't like about being Patty Hearst, it was that the people she met generally responded to her as Patty Hearst. You know, the daughter of Randolph Hearst, and she didn't like that. She didn't like that kind of instant, easy identification, and I think was looking for some other way to be in the world. And it was that kind of ordinary life that she had with Stephen Weed in Berkeley that you're describing.
So let's go back and get a little refresher course on how the kidnapping all played out. She was abducted about 2 weeks before she turned 20 from this little townhouse that she was sharing with Stephen Weed, her fiancé. How did Americans first take the news when the headlines broke?
Well, I think for the first 8 weeks, the sense was that this was, a great tragedy. It wasn't only for her. The public opinion was, solidly behind her, despite the fact that that almost immediately tapes of her voice, some of them critical of her parents and so forth, began to come out. And but there was just, shock on the part of the public that an event like this could happen.
I guess the sense when those early recordings came out might have been that indeed she was being coerced.
Well, it was. That's right. And I think it's coerced in the sense of just simply, saying whatever they wanted her to say. And then in the fifth tape, which is actually late in this process, about 8 weeks in, she says that she joins the SLA. She actually says, "I joined the," and in a certain way she did. She agreed that she would become a member. She said that to them, and she said that publicly on the tape. And then there's this, we have the rise of this notion that, well, if she said that, she must be brainwashed. So here at this point, probably earlier for some, but clearly at this point, brainwashing enters the picture as a possible explanation for why she would say things like that, why she would have done something like that.
Now, brainwashing was the sort of concept that people were talking about a lot back then, but it was very much informed by the military's perspective on what it was and how it could be used. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I can. The defense in her case relied on psychiatric witnesses, and they all presented some version or another of the brainwashing. I would call it the brainwashing defense. They didn't use that term. They preferred to call it coercive persuasion. That is, she was persuaded in a coercive environment, and there are various definitions of this. Some 14 points, of the sort of coercive persuasion techniques. But for example, Dr. Lewis West, who testified on her behalf, looked at Korean War pilots who had been subject to coercive persuasion, and then had said things, been led to say things or said things against the United States in public to make statements. Dr. Martin Orne testified that Vietnam POWs had, in some cases, been subject to coercive persuasion. Another example, that was brought up during the trial, was that of Cardinal Menzenti, who was a famous Catholic prelate of the time, who in 1948 was captured by the communists in Hungary, and subject to coercive persuasion to some kinds of brainwashing techniques, to deprivation of various forms, kinds, and ultimately produced a confession of sorts that was well-publicized by the communists. So there was lots of information at the trial on this kind of these possibilities. It was really new, though. It was a new for criminal law. There was no precedent in the criminal law for a brainwashing defense to a particular crime. It's one of the interesting and, I think, legally probably important parts of the trial.
Patricia Hearst herself has said since that time that initially she actually thought that she was being kidnapped by a splinter of what must have been a much larger group. What did the world know about the Symbionese Liberation Army at this time?
Well, they didn't. There were various estimates on the part of officials once they about how large this group was. Some thought it might be 25 people. I don't think the law enforcement people thought it was large. You're right. Patty was told by her captors that this group was all over the country, and this was just a small cell. And it wasn't actually until she agreed to join the group and was told the truth. She said, "Well, where are all the rest of you?" And they said, "Well, this is it. What you see is what you get. There were only a dozen, or less, and a couple were already in prison." But what people actually knew about the group was that they had taken responsibility for the killing of Marcus Foster, the black Oakland and quite popular superintendent of the Oakland Public Schools, with cyanide bullets. Really a vicious crime that even some of the most radical organizations in the country withdrew from and say this is just wrong. But they did kill him and did take responsibility for it about 3 months before she was kidnapped. So they knew from that point that this was a vicious group, you know, that could do anything.
And
I think that was accurate.
And they claimed to stand for the rights of the downtrodden, essentially the poor and people of color.
Well, they did, and I think it would be easy to dismiss that, and it certainly doesn't sit well with the Marcus Foster killing or some of the other things that they advocated. But at bottom, they were Marxists. They believed in equality. They believed in racial equality. They believed in gender equality. Although they didn't necessarily act that way within the organization. And they had this sense that the country was a fascist state in the largest sense of the word. That there were the government, the big businesses, none of these people could be trusted to do the right thing. The consumer society and bourgeois life were worthless, while these ideas weren't widely shared, certainly their interest in poverty, their interest in feeding the hungry, their interest in prisoners' rights, that was all of these were, if not mainstream values, they were values that lots of people held, especially in the late 60s and the early 1970s. So to the extent that there was any sympathy for the group, and there was some, despite the Foster murder, especially among African-Americans and the desperately poor, I suspect. I probably couldn't prove that, but I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought.
Let's go. One of the things I know that they demanded, that the Hearst family tried initially to comply with, was that a great deal of money be given to feed the poor and the hungry in and around Oakland and throughout California.
That's right, yeah. In fact, they demanded, I think, $70 of food for every poor person in the state of California through distribution through various centers. The Hearst family announced that this was way more money than Randolph Hearst had or could raise, and eventually a $6 million. Randolph Hearst came up with $2 million and a couple of foundations that he was associated with. Added $4 million and food, and so about $6 million worth of food was distributed, sometimes chaotically, sometimes in an orderly fashion.
And as the country was watching this, some people were really turned off by who showed up for the food.
Well, there were some. There were apparently some people who had money who would come by in their Cadillacs, and I suppose that's just par for the course when you engage in something this quickly and without a clear, orderly distribution system. And they were pretty much handing stuff off of trucks to whoever wanted it. But that was also, I suppose the most important reaction would have been, well, do the poor need feeding or don't they? That would seem to me, and it did raise that issue dramatically, just like, say Katrina raised the issue of the poor in New Orleans dramatically, and it raised consciousness of that issue. I think that's probably more important than the fact that some of the food went to people who didn't deserve it. There was a sense, too, I might add, some people thought the poor wouldn't take it. You know, that it was beneath them, beneath them to accept food that was basically extorted after a kidnapping. But by and large, they did. Some didn't, but the food was taken.
Author William Gravener is with us. His new book is called Patty's Got a Gun, Patricia Hearst in 1970s America. You can get on the line now to join the conversation. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can follow your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Author William Graebner is my guest. His new book is called Patty's Got a Gun, Patricia Hearst in 1970s America. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. When Patricia Hearst was finally arrested, she had been missing for more than a year and a half. At one point, though, it was actually believed that she was killed along with the leader of the SLA. Can you talk about that incident? And she was actually watching the whole thing on television.
Yeah, sure. Let's just go back to the chronology.
Bill, are you with us? We are having a problem with our phone line. We will get Bill Graebner back in just a minute. The new book is called Patty's Got a Gun, Patricia Hearst in 1970s America. It tells the story not only of the Patricia Hearst abduction and ultimate trial, for which she was convicted and sentenced to 7 years in prison. It also tells the story of the zeitgeist of America in the 1970s and how the culture was affected by what was going on with Patricia Hearst and how Patricia Hearst's case was likely affected by the general tide of culture at the time. Graebner argues that the entire case with Patricia Hearst being convicted and being viewed as an aggressor as opposed to any kind of victim had a lot to do with the growing calls in the United States for personal responsibility. If you want to join our conversation this afternoon, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send an email to think@kera.org. Again, the book is called Patty's Got a Gun, Patricia Hearst in the 1960s. Hearst, of course, was kidnapped at gunpoint when she was 19 years old. She was heir to the Hearst fortune. Her father was a newspaper publisher. Her grandfather was the man who Orson Welles portrayed fictionally in Citizen Kane. She fell in with her captors not long after she was abducted, participating in armed robberies, denouncing her wealthy family, and evading federal authorities. Later, she argued in court that she had been brainwashed, brutalized, sexually abused, and that she only complied with the SLA out of fear for her life. We have Bill Graebner back on the phone now. Thanks so much for your patience, Bill.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
That happens with phones all the time. So let's talk for a minute about you were at a point where you were explaining what happened before she was actually found to be alive. And you're going to take us back.
Well,
a bit.
I was explaining the group goes down to Los Angeles, and it's in Los Angeles that the authorities find the safe house of the SLA, and within hours it's burned to the ground, and six members of the SLA are dead, asphyxiated or burned or shot, actually. Two of them are shot. And Patty and two other members of the SLA who happened to be on a shopping trip at the time, and so not in the house or near it, are watching this event on a... actually from a motel, and Patty's just horrified. I think she goes into the bathroom, and she's in tears. I mean, some of these people, despite what's happened to her, are dear to her on some level, and beyond that, she realizes that that she could have been one of those people who was killed, the Los Angeles police didn't know when the building went up in flames that she was inside or not. So she realizes, I mean, the lesson she takes from that is that she is now being treated as just like any other, wanted criminal, and that she can, could be shot on sight or die at any minute, and that the government can't be trusted.
So at this point, this really solidifies her sense of belonging to the SLA at the time. Later on, she was heavily criticized for never trying to escape. Can you talk about what she said about that?
Well, yeah, she had ample opportunities to escape, and that was clear to the jury. Ample. For example, she traveled all across the country with the parents of Jack Scott, who was a kind of physical fitness guru, sports guru, and with his parents, and could of course at any moment have gone to the police. I mean, it takes a long time to drive across the country. There were large periods where she was not with Bill Harris or Emily Harris, who were the remaining parts of the SLA, weeks at a time. And that was true when she was on the East Coast. It was true when she was back in Sacramento and the Bay Area after a few months. So plenty of opportunities to escape. During the she explained that she was in, at the trial. She said she was in such fear that she knew that if she tried to escape, they would get her, you know, even if they didn't get her at that moment, that they would find her and get her, whether she was in prison or with the police or living someplace else, as I describe in the book, it's a kind of paranoia, really. I think it was paranoia. But I also explained that at least in the 1970s, the paranoia was a common value. I mean, it was hard to trust anyone in the 1970s after Watergate and, you know, various CIA assassination attempts of world leaders that had been revealed and Nixon's enemies list and so forth. So it still stretches the credibility a bit. I would say.
Mm-hmm. And there was really no. By the time she was ultimately arrested, there was really no sympathy left for her. People really, since she hadn't been a heroine, they wanted to see her as a villain. And the potential for Americans to see her as a victim had pretty much evaporated.
Well, yes, until she testifies. I mean, in her testimony, there's some lingering interest in her, in what had happened to her. And there's some people who just never really get beyond the fact that it all wouldn't have happened if it hadn't been for the kidnapping, which is true. But by and large, you're right, Chris, that that deep sympathy for her that was there at the beginning had evaporated. That's right. And partly because of this, I mean, or maybe importantly because she had failed to escape. They really wanted something out of her. They didn't want a victim. They wanted a heroic figure, and that goes to the, I suppose, the kind of essence of the decade. You know, they wasn't the. It's a bit like current times, actually. We're going, the country is in a very deep recession in 1973 and 1974, and the Vietnam War had proved to be was over, but a bit of a failure, to say the least. These were not good times, and there was a sense that, you know, heroic action was called for, and that's really what people wanted.
Yeah, and to sort of widen this out, people in some ways could identify with all this going on to the extent that a lot of other sort of nice young people, in the way that their parents might have defined them, had also, if not been brainwashed, even in a figurative sense, had sort of renounced their parents' values and made decisions that felt very different. And people were tired of hearing that it was someone else's fault. That young people were changing in these ways.
Well, that's right. There was a sense again that the 60s had to be put behind us as a nation, that we'd really had enough of it, I'm trying to think. There was also the sense that. Just to look briefly at the criminal law, that people were tired of sort of finding reasons why people committed crimes, or understanding criminals as victims, or understanding prisoners as essentially victims, you know, of say abuse or a bad family upbringing or something. And they really were turning toward ideas of individual responsibility. And insisting that people have free will, as opposed to kind of the old determinist sensibilities that were part of the 1960s and even into the early 70s.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. William Graebner is my guest. His new book is called Patty's Got a Gun, Patricia Hearst in 1970s America. You can also send email to us this afternoon at think@kera.org. On the line now, we have Randy in Dallas. Hi, Randy.
Hey, I'm so glad to hear your guest and to have this topic talked about. I remember this having been alive when it happened, and my memory is that at the time she was captured, she was in the presence of her then boyfriend, I think his name was Steve something, and I vaguely remember him having written a book called My Life with Patty afterwards. But I'm just curious, whatever happened to this guy who went from being engaged to an heiress to, you know, not being engaged to an heiress?
Oh, Stephen Weed?
There you go.
Yeah, he
what
did write a, he did write a book about I think it's called My Search for Patty Hearst. He was very, very active during the this event. You know, held a number of news conferences. Some people thought too many, and he certainly irritated the family from what I can tell. I actually don't know his career trajectory after this, but I do know that he's living in the Bay Area, and he was kind enough to allow me to reprint one of his photographs in my book, and I was kind of shocked that he would. I thought, well, he certainly doesn't want any more of this, and he didn't seem to mind at all. So I thought, but that's, I don't really know what he's doing.
Patricia Hearst ultimately ended up marrying her bodyguard not very long at all after she got out of prison.
That's right, and apparently she's still married to him. Mm-hmm. So that worked out. I think she married him in 1979. I believe they're living in New York City, where she does dog shows and makes an occasional movie with John Waters.
I was going to say Normal Life, but the John Waters thing. She's done several of them with him.
Yeah, she's done, I think, five films. Cecil B. DeMented was one, and Pecker was another, which I saw Pecker, and but I didn't remember until I was reading about this that she'd been in the film. She also did one stint on Frasier as a call-in to his psychology show.
Oh, sure. They always did cameos with people. So
right. Yeah.
We have an email from Madeline who says, I remember hearing John Wayne quoted after the Jonestown Massacre, something to the effect that if one guy could get 1,000 people to drink poison Kool-Aid, why don't we believe that a bunch of kidnappers could brainwash one little bitty girl?
That's right. Yeah. Actually, he was, I just saw that comment recently, and that's right. Wayne came to her defense with that, which I'm kind of shocked at. You would think he would be on the other side of the sort of individual responsibility perspective. The other person who actually did late in the process on one of his radio addresses was Ronald Reagan, who had a kind of interesting perspective. He thought that if Patty Hearst hadn't been rich, that she might have gotten off. That the public would have been much more sympathetic to a poor girl. And so it was really just a kind of discrimination against the rich that produced the verdict in the trial. So you never know what people are going to come up with.
Well, you almost wonder if John Wayne in particular had a more fundamental understanding of the fact that making someone a white hero or a black villain is really something that only happens in the movies, that the story is never quite that simple in real life.
That could be. There was a sense, I think much of the public wanted a black and, wanted it black or white. You know, they didn't like this sense of not knowing, of a kind of, that Patty might be some kind of complex amalgam of things, might have been partly brainwashed, might have been educated, might have been attracted, might have been partly repulsed. I mean, I think her situation, I think she was a combination of things, but there were large parts of the American population in the mid 70s who wanted clarity. This was especially true, for example, of the Moral Majority, which wasn't founded until 79, but it was. But the elements of it were coalescing in the mid 1970s, and this was they just wanted right and wrong, yes or no, and the whole Patty Hearst case must have been really irritating to those people.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. William Graebner is here. His book is called Patty's Got a Gun, Patricia Hearst in 1970s America. Let's go next to Duncanville, where we find Barry. Hi, Barry.
Hi. I wanted to say I'm really enjoying the show. My question is, at the time of the trial, there were some theories probably in the media that maybe Patty Hearst had been involved in actually staging the kidnapping I was wondering if your guest had any thoughts on that, and I'll take my answer off there.
Thanks for your call.
Okay, thank you.
That was a theory that was floated. There's nothing that I've ever read, would confirm that. I don't think that's true. I don't know what else to suggest. I'm trying to think what it would mean to suggest that she had. Actually, I do know what it would suggest. I mean, one of the things that's happening in the early 1970s is a kind of new sense of celebrity, and it is conceivable that, in the context of that new idea of celebrity, that one can be a kind of do something really unusual, be an instant celebrity, and raise one's public profile over a matter of hours, that somebody like that Patty, I mean, you can imagine Patty Hearst, say, you can imagine it as a kind of theoretical thing, Patty Hearst deciding that that's what she wanted. She wanted to be an instant celebrity, and she's going to, create her own, generate her own kidnapping and so forth. But that's the last thing she wanted, actually. I don't think she was that kind of person at all, as her background in Berkeley before the kidnapping attests.
Was she willing to talk to you about the book?
I'm sorry?
Was she willing to talk to you about the book? Did you try
to
contact her?
I didn't talk to her. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether she would be willing. I've never been a strong enthusiast for oral history, and she wrote a very good book called Every Secret Thing it was published in 1982. This is really what she's said. So I looked very carefully at the trial transcript and very carefully at her book, and decided that, my guess was that she really probably wouldn't, all these years later, have anything new that would be to say that would be accurate. She might have reformulated some ideas, but I wasn't so interested in the reformulation.
William Gravener is my guest. His new book is called Patty's Got a Gun, Patricia Hearst in 1970s America. If you want to join us, you can get on the line at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can follow your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. William Gravener is my guest. His new book is called Patty's Got a Gun, Patricia Hearst in 1970s America. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Bill, I have to ask you, what got you thinking about the Patty Hearst case again, and what made you decide to approach it really from the viewpoint of what it says about the entire culture at the time?
Well, the last question is pretty simple. I mean, that's really the kind of history I've been doing for the last 10 or 15 years, cultural history. And that's what I enjoy doing, is taking an event and saying, okay, why is there all this interest in the case? That is, why are large numbers of people paying attention to a particular event? So it's a kind of analysis that I like to do. In the case of Patty, I actually remembered not much about it. I mean, I didn't remember much about it from the 70s, because I was involved in getting tenure and raising a five-year-old and
those little things that
and
keep
that
you busy.
Sort of thing. But the I'd been doing some work on the 70s, essays on the 70s, one on heroes and another on zombie films and their meaning in the 1970s and 60s. And then I thought, well, this is the Patty Hearst story. It's a great story. It's a wonderful story. And my first thought was just to write an article. I'll just describe what happened to Patty in a couple of pages, and then I'll analyze it. That was my idea. And I realized that just didn't make sense. And I just kind of grew like Topsy. And by, by the time I knew it, I had, I had 100 pages, and I told the story. I told it in my own way with my own emphases, but, and then I went on to, then I thought, well, this is really a book. You know, it's not an article. And so it evolved. The project evolved. It's a wonderful story. I mean, it's so rich in analytic possibilities.
Yeah, the zombie connection is interesting because a lot of people describe Patty Hearst when they saw her at the trial as appearing sort of zombie-like.
Yes, yeah. It was actually used, the word was used frequently a number of times by Shana Alexander in her book of the time called Anyone's Daughter. And others referred to this look too. And so I became interested in just what that meant. And of course, it does have some relationship to zombies. But actually, that brings me to my article on zombies. One of the things I decided in writing about zombie films was that the zombie was a Holocaust figure. Actually, it was the Holocaust victim. I know it's hard to prove that, but that's. We'll have to read the article if I ever publish it. And so in a certain sense was, a Patty identified with the whole victimization, syndrome of the Holocaust. I mean, in fact, some of the testimony was about the Robert J. Lifton, for example, in her defense was about the Nazi concentration camps and what they did to people, and. And so I think that, I don't know if she cultivated that image for the trial, that sort of pale, almost morbid look that Shana Alexander observed, or if she was just in a kind of shock by that point. So those are my thoughts.
An email from Rollins says, I slept on the street literally to get into the Patty Hearst trial. There were only about 3 spots available for non-press. I sat behind Hearst's mother and her sister, eavesdropping. Hearst was tiny and frail and fragile. Mm. It was amazing to see her on the witness stand. She looked for all the world like someone at any Starbucks.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. I've been thinking about this frail image, too, because one of the things that I think she really, I hate to say it, enjoyed about the SLA was, on some level, was its physicality. I mean, this was a Symbionese Liberation Army. And as an army, they did all these calisthenics and exercises. And even when they came back, a year later, I mean, they were back in Sacramento, she and the others would go jogging for sometimes long runs, 4 miles, and of course they did all these kind of military exercises where they would take their weapons and jump and leap and roll over and pretend to shoot and so forth. So it was a very physical experience, and I think she. You know, she describes her youth, as I suggested earlier, as a physical youth, and she enjoyed kind of developing that a harder body. But then, of course, she's arrested in September. Her trial is until February, I think. And maybe she just stopped exercising. But I think by the time she was captured, she probably had a pretty good physique for her. So, difficult to know.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Greg in Dallas. Hi, Greg.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Your author was speaking earlier about when the SLA had demanded that food be given to poor people. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I remember about that is that allegedly Ronald Reagan said something to the words to the effect of, this will be a nice time for an outbreak of botulism. Is that just an urban legend, or did he really say it? Could you talk about that and give us some insight for a minute? I'll listen off there.
Thanks for your call.
I think he really said it. But that's my sense because I've read the remark myself. But I haven't done any rigorous research to demonstrate that he really said it. That is, I didn't take it as a research exercise. Did he really say these words? They are outrageous, but of course, they were set in the context of Reagan's actually dislike of all radicals, let alone the kind represented by the SLA. So it's understandable that he would say something as outrageous as that.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Jeff in Fort Worth. Hello, Jeff.
Hey, how are you doing?
Great, thanks.
enjoying the show.
Great.
I was, you know, a child growing up. I was born in 62, so I'm 45, almost 46 now. And I just remember the whole Patty Hearst story being such a big deal. And as I, you know, I think back on the 70s, I have a lot of memories, but I remember that being just a big deal in my life at that time. And the sense of confusion as a child of trying to figure out, you know, what's going on. And I think it's funny today is that I don't feel any more sure about what happened than I did when I was, you know, 10 years old or whenever, wherever, you know, however old it was. But just as a cultural phenomenon, that whole Patty Hearst thing in the 70s, definitely one of those footnotes that defines the whole era. So just my thoughts.
Thanks for your call.
So your caller was born in 62?
Yeah.
Right? So it would have been 12 or 13. And, you know, I think one of the really disturbing things that we haven't talked about was that I'm sure affected lots of people, was the sense of that Patty could become Tanya, could become Pearl, could become somebody completely different. And that must have, I can imagine that was very disturbing for lots of people, maybe especially a 12-year-old, you know, who's asking, well, you know, or a 13-year-old, what, you know, just what am I? Am I, you know, what is this self that I have? You know, do I have a solid core here, or could I be something different tomorrow or a month from now, something dramatically different? Could I be a criminal? I mean, these were central questions in the 1970s for lots of people. I mean, the problem of the self, stability of the self, what people were, say the whole interest in cults. You know, there was a deep concern about cults. Was really about that. You know, could your daughter, could your son be sort of spirited away and changed dramatically over a short period of time into something that you don't recognize? So I think your caller's concerns are well taken.
Yeah, you have cults, and even you write in the book about movies like The Stepford Wives that all sort of play with this idea of what the self really is and who can be replaced and by what.
Well, that's right. Yeah, The Stepford Wives was a book published in 72 and then made into a 75 film that not everybody likes, but I think it's pretty interesting, and in which a suburban club of a men's club figure out a way to turn their to create robot-like creatures that resemble their wives, but will do the dishes and I suppose sexual favors, but are not won't challenge them when they say want to go bowling or something like that. But there's that fantasy, you know, of that science and technology has become so powerful that indeed that sort of thing might be possible. Genetic engineering was another component of anxieties like that. And there were a whole spate of possession films in the 1970s, beginning with the Exorcist, the famous film The Exorcist. And they're really about people being taken over, being changed instantly, being taken over by the devil. You know, as Flip Wilson used to say in jest, the devil made me do it. And, you know, what could one do? I mean, all these forces sort of arrayed against one, whether it's religion or genetic engineering or other kinds of science and technology or a kind of cloning, as in that appears in Invasion of the Body Snatchers, you know, an important remake in 1978. The sense, of the self is just not very stable, not very solid, easily changed, into something new. And that's what, it's not that Patty Hearst produced this sense, it's that she just reminded people that that's the society we live in, where one's own being is not as dependable as it ought to be.
Looking back now, with the perspective of hindsight, was there a defense strategy that actually might have worked to get her acquitted?
Oh boy, that's a good one. You know, I suppose my argument is basically no, you know, because I think the time had passed when the obvious strategies of that Bailey used, of victimization. You know, here we have essentially a victim, a frightened woman doing everything she possibly can to stay alive. Those would have worked a few years earlier, certainly a decade earlier. But we're, you know, as the 70s moves on, we've got there's increasing opposition to those. I think what Bailey could have done, he certainly could have made a more effective closing. His closing was, by all, I found it just, I was, as I'm reading the trial transcript, I found it confused, and certainly not as not up to the government's argument in the final stages. So it's possible if he'd been more effective, in those closing moments, the jury might have paid attention. But my sense is no, that there was just too much going against her in the climate of the mid 1970s.
By my calculation, Bill, there were easily half a dozen cases called the trial of the century in the 20th century. I'm wondering if you think that every generation has one event that isn't maybe necessarily a central event, but that still sort of can be used in the same way to define what people are thinking about.
I don't know. I mean, trying to think. Well, I suppose every generation kind of looks for these things, and if they appear and if they're powerful enough, then they become these seminal events, like Woodstock, for example, for a particular group, especially in the 1960s. Charles Lindbergh's Flight of the Atlantic was something that captured not only the imagination of Americans but of the whole world in 1927, other events. I mean, more recent, the O.J. Simpson trial was certainly important for our sense of ideas about race and criminal justice. More recently, and in the 70s, I think clearly the Patty Hearst trial, and I would say the Iranian hostage crisis of 1979 are two of these events that are extremely important for people.
Can we draw any conclusions about the way America has changed based on how Patty Hearst herself sort of remade her life after this all ended?
We no longer belong to a world of cults, and I'm trying to imagine what your question means here. You mean
I guess I was going to the ways that we have changed since then. Sadly, I make a terrible habit of asking these questions when you have just seconds left to go.
Yeah.
So we're essentially out of time now. But it's a fascinating read for a lot of reasons. And hopefully people will have a chance to check out the book. William Grabner's new book is called Patty's Got a Gun, Patricia Hearst in 1970s America. Bill, thanks so much for spending the hour with us.
Well, thank you, Chris. It's been a pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.